Welcome back. I'm Peter St. Ange. This is a weekly roundup of my daily videos on the economy and freedom, where I try to cut through the BS and the smoke and mirrors and lay out exactly what the clowns are trying to do to you and what is coming next. I'm also active on Twitter and Substack, so I hope to see you there. Joe Biden's handlers and their GOP counterparts have been working hard, burning the midnight oil, even neglecting donor calls, to hammer out a budget deal ahead of Janet Yellen's long-promised X date of June 1, when, if the GOP does nothing, America shall finally be free of deficits. Unfortunately, the two sides apparently had long and allegedly fruitful discussions Sunday night and plan to meet again today. So far, with little progress, fruitful or not, going by financial markets, who I have to assume get plenty of leaks, given brokers' very warm relationships with the day traders in Congress. Indeed, the VIX, the market's fear gauge, hasn't really budged at all during the debt ceiling crisis, suggesting the money thinks it's all play acting. While media is highlighting McCarthy's reckless intransigence, which I would love to be true, so far and as expected, the GOP is negotiating with itself. It's currently lowering its spending cap from 10 years down to 6 years, with some floating a single year. Meanwhile, Biden is offering 2 years, oddly enough, greater than 1 year, but that is calculated to get past the 2024 elections, presumably because Biden's people plan to spend an ungodly amount between now and then and don't want to answer for it. In short, it looks like the GOP is doing what it always does: talk big, and then climb down, beg for enough crumbs that they don't look stupid back home. According to the Wall Street Journal, at this point, the two sides are, quote, within $200 billion over 10 years, which is pretty disappointing considering that doing absolutely nothing and just letting the ceiling do its thing and stop deficits would save roughly $19 trillion over 10 years. So do nothing and save $19 trillion, or fruitfully negotiate into the wee hours and drop it by 99% and falling fast. Now, we pretty much know how this one ends, given that seven of the last debt limit increases featured, in Mitch McConnell's words, quote, bipartisan deals on spending levels. Because look at what that got us. In those 10 years, yes, we have approximately one debt showdown per year, federal spending went from $3.5 trillion to over $6 trillion. So those are your hardworking bipartisan spending dealers at work. And so in all likelihood, here comes number eight. Of course, the amazing thing here is that if the GOP, they could get the budget deal of the century by one clever trick of doing nothing, which would immediately end the deficits, a $1.4 trillion effective spending cut this year alone, with many trillions to come, which, as I mentioned in yesterday's video, would also fix inflation and turn the recession in one fell swoop. Sadly, given a choice between stopping the freight train by doing nothing, the GOP instead opts for fruitful negotiations that bring it from 80 miles per hour to 79.8 miles per hour, in theory, but it, given past form, actually greenlight it to 90. And so, barring a miracle, Santa Claus is not bringing a debt ceiling this year, meaning it is back to inflation, recession, bank crashes, your job and your life savings sacrificed so Washington can keep spending. A few days ago, JP Morgan, already America's biggest mega bank, announced it is making a lot of money in this banking crisis, as it did in the last one. It went on to warn that there's a lot more bank crashes to come, which presumably it also hopes will be as profitable as the bank crashes so far. JP is now planning to make $84 billion in net interest income, which is up about $10 billion since April, mostly because regional bank failures are sending depositors running by the million to the too-big-to-fail banks like JP Morgan, who enjoy an implicit taxpayer bailout. Of course, that $84 billion is on top of JP Morgan's fire sale buy of First Republic, which was fire sale priced because you, the taxpayer, donated $63 billion. So far, this has been a very good crisis for JP Morgan. Now there are CEOs on TV all but giggling that there's much more to come, because so far we have only seen Act 1 of what the Fed is planning to do to us, the rate hikes. Act 2 has not even begun: quantitative tightening. So what is quantitative tightening? It is when a central bank sells stuff instead of buying stuff. So normally, if a central bank wants to artificially boost the economy for political reasons, which central banks almost always want to do, it does that by flooding money into the economy. By printing money, it literally types a bunch of zeros on a spreadsheet, and then using those zeros to buy stuff like government bonds or mortgages. This leaves them owning a bunch of bonds, but it pushes new money into the economy, which makes people feel rich. It also makes loans cheap, so even really stupid businesses can get money, like Pets.com, WeWork, or Beyond Meat. Of course, printing money makes inflation. So central bankers will try to cancel it by doing the opposite, selling all that stuff they bought. Quantitative tightening. So they sell a government bond for $1 million. They take that million and cancel it. They delete the zeros. It's the money printer in reverse. The problem is that's all in theory. The two times they actually tried doing it in 2013 and 2019, it failed spectacularly, causing never before seen spikes in interbank loans and treasury markets. So both times they quickly gave up. In other words, going by actual experience, printing money is like salting dinner. It is easy to add. It is very hard to take away. The thing is, this time they cannot give up because they are out of options. The Fed can see the economy is turning. It knows it cannot hike into a crash, but inflation is not going anywhere, meaning they have to tighten and pray it doesn't break too much this time. So nobody knows what breaks first or how bad, but between Morgan's giggling and the Fed's track record, in all likelihood, there's going to be a lot more banks and who knows what else on Wall Street's menu, each in all likelihood with a generous bailout signed by you. Stock markets and gold prices are starting to consider the possibility that the GOP might just have balls. I mean, the smart money still says no, but we are starting to get the first indications. I was actually on Charles Payne's show yesterday when the market turned, ironically saying what I said in Monday's video, that bored markets, meaning gold and volatility, are saying the GOP will fold like, quote, cheap furniture. Not 5 minutes later, markets started tanking. So first, the status of the negotiations, and then what it all means. On Monday, the House Freedom Caucus, which is my favorite caucus, urged McCarthy to, quote, hold the line and simply let the Senate vote on the bill the House already passed that cuts nearly $5 trillion in spending over the next decade, a very respectable showing. After all, the big spenders are the ones asking for the debt ceiling hike, so let them make the concessions. Former President Trump also chimed in, urging McCarthy to hold out for, quote, the kitchen sink. Meanwhile, a group of 10 Democrats made a goofy offer to back McCarthy for leadership if he betrays the Freedom Caucus members who originally secured his leadership spot. Of course, it's a stupid offer. McCarthy is not a traitor, but it highlights that McCarthy is backed into a corner. Biden's handlers, meanwhile, are also facing pressure from their progressives who dream of every dollar you earn being run through a bureaucrat like coffee beans through a civet. But of course, Biden can't be bundled out of power like McCarthy could if he folds. So for now, and gloriously, markets are starting to realize maybe there won't be a deal after all. After remaining calm all through the so-called debt ceiling crisis, the Dow yesterday dropped 200 points, gold and Bitcoin both went up, and the VIX volatility index spiked to the highest in 3 weeks. So it's still nowhere near, quote, crisis levels, but the first glimmer that Republicans could actually get something this time. By the way, everybody's favorite predatory bank, JP Morgan, piled in saying to short small company stocks. No, this is the same JP Morgan who just a few weeks ago wanted to prosecute short sellers of bank stocks, but are apparently eager to take a dump on the dining room table of any small business they can. Now, there's still little hope of my admittedly unrealistic dream of a default that issues new debt for the widows and orphans and screws China and Wall Street, but it is edging closer to my slightly more realistic dream of just letting the debt ceiling hit so we get a free balanced budget amendment and end the deficits immediately. Of course, the smart money is still on what's always happened, a uniparty sellout that slows the runaway freight train from 80 miles an hour to 79.8 on paper, so they can pump that baby to 90 once the news cycle moves on. Still, every day they're not making deals, and every day the markets notice is a good one. Is the Federal Reserve back to crushing the economy? Will there be anything left? Until recently, the Fed was confidently hinting, and markets were predicting, that they were done with hikes, that they'd pause, look around a little so it's not too obvious that they went too far too fast, and then they would start cutting. This was eagerly anticipated since it would give some breathing room to banks. Well, at least it would pour gasoline on the banking fire. And it would be prudent given there is a well-known lag between rate hikes and impact on the economy, typically around 12 to 18 months. Given rate hikes didn't really get restrictive, meaning above 2019 levels, until September, that is only 8 months ago, which is neither 12 nor 18 months. So we don't even know what the hikes they've already done are going to break, meaning the prudent thing would be to stop hiking. Well, actually, the prudent thing would be for Powell and Yellen to tell Congress to cut federal spending so inflation can come down on its own. That's not going to happen, but at least they could stop breaking things. Sadly, it is not to be. Yesterday, influential Fed Governor Waller surprised markets by saying even if they pause, he wants to get right back to the hikes. Waller noted what I've been saying on these videos, that inflation is not going anywhere, despite the most aggressive round of rate hikes in 50 years. He noted 6 out of 7 of the Fed's inflation measures are currently flashing red. Of course, he didn't mention the other thing I've been saying, to cut federal spending, but he's doing his best. Waller also cited housing numbers, which are holding up, and consumer spending, which is also holding up. This makes him think there's enough life yet in the real economy that it needs a couple more kicks in the head so it stays down, clearing the road for the federal government to spend everything their tiny little hearts desire. Of course, both housing and consumers are currently false signals. Houses are holding up because nobody is selling. Even if the kids go to college, you'd have to trade a 3% mortgage for a 7% mortgage. It is much better to just hold on until rates come down. Meanwhile, consumer spending usually does rise going into a recession. In fact, it's a main reason we have recessions in the first place. Resources shift from heavily subsidized investment, subsidized by easy money, to the less subsidized consumer industries people actually want. So home prices are predicting rate cuts, in other words, a recession, while consumer spending is also predicting a recession that, given that spending is floating on credit card debt and buying groceries on installment, could be a very painful one. Now, lest we hope that's just Governor Waller hitting the bottle, fresh Fed meeting minutes are now saying the same thing. The Fed is a deer in the headlights, terrified that all their burning and pillaging has failed to kill the real economy, meaning going by Fed rate probabilities, we are looking at even more pain from the Fed on top of the quantitative tightening I mentioned 2 days ago, with no let up for at least another 7 months. Governments worldwide are pushing totalitarian CBDCs that voters hate, yet they keep pushing. So what is coming next? I have a new article coming out next week on CBDC, specifically on a Republican bill that would actually greenlight a CBDC using government contractors. So I want to take a moment to consider some of these CBDCs that already exist as a cautionary tale. First, what is a CBDC? It is a crypto token that replaces the national currency, say the US dollar, with a government-run tracking ledger that lets bureaucrats surveil, control, and mandate every dollar you spend. They can prevent you from buying the wrong thing, whether it's raw milk or gas stoves or self-defense. They could stop you from donating to the wrong person, like we saw with the Canadian truckers. They could even force you to buy whatever a government bureaucrat tells you to. On top of the Soviet-style surveillance state, a CBDC is also an existential threat to the banking system, to the US dollars, and it would give central planners push-button control over every element of your life. Now, as you'd expect, CBDCs are astoundingly unpopular across political party. Polls in the U.S. regularly show about 80 to 90% opposition. Yet, governments keep pushing them, presumably because surveillance and central planning are simply too delicious to walk away from, while lobbyist dollars are just as tasty. Worldwide, so far, there have been two major implementations of a CBDC. The first was China, which has never met a totalitarian technology it does not love. The second was Nigeria. In 2021, the Nigerian government pushed out its CBDC, the e-Naira. Almost nobody used it. Uptake was about 0.5%, which is pretty rough in a population that is among the most crypto savvy in the world. So over a third of Nigerians own Bitcoin and over half use crypto. So it's not the technology. Nigerians just really hate CBDCs. Given this pathetic showing, the Nigerian government then turned to hardball. First, they mandated discounts for paying in CBDCs. Then they redesigned the physical currency to flush out informal cash. Finally, they went nuclear, limiting cash withdrawals from ATMs to $40 per day to force people into the CBDC and to achieve a, quote, 100% cashless economy. Now, the informal cash-based economy in Nigeria is an enormous share of output. It's life or death for Nigeria's 200 million people because it's the only part outside government control, meaning it's the only part of Nigeria's economy that actually works. This meant that the cash limits led to complete chaos. People could not buy groceries, stores could not stock their shelves, gas stations ran out of fuel in the largest oil-producing country in Africa. Nigeria was rocked by widespread riots, including burning down banks and even central bank branches. By the way, the American-backed contractor who built Nigeria's CBDC was asked about the cash limits and the riots they caused. He praised the restrictions as a, quote, creative option that he expects to happen in other countries that impose CBDCs, making Nigeria a cautionary tale. So as much as people worldwide hate CBDCs, governments worldwide love them. Between the totalitarian surveillance, the control, and the godlike central planning of a CBDC, they will not stop until voters make them stop. Last week, former Dallas Fed President Kaplan, former as in he can tell the truth, gave an interview saying, quote, "We are now headed into the third phase of the bank crisis." Right on cue, fresh money market numbers popped out showing the biggest jump in money draining out of banks since the very first week of the bank crisis way back in March. It was a fairly dire number, $47 billion on the week, to a record high of $5.4 trillion currently parked in money markets. For scale, that's about a quarter of all the money in all the bank accounts in America. And it's up almost $1 trillion in the past year, half of that in the past 2 months alone. So the bank runs may have dropped out of the headlines, at least temporarily, thanks to trillion-dollar pre-bailouts, but they appear to have metastasized into a grinding flood, a bank walk, out of especially regional banks that's currently running $8 billion per day. By the way, at an $8 billion daily drain, the entire banking system outside the big four would shrink by half in roughly 2 years. And that brings us to Kaplan's third phase. Essentially, banks are in trouble already from losses on their assets, their bonds, their loans, all thanks to reckless Fed hikes. And banks are now realizing that more trouble is coming from the slowing economy. The problem, according to Kaplan, is that banks cannot raise new money to plug their balance sheets since investors are afraid to buy bank stocks, meaning the regional bank's only way to plug their holes is to shrink their loan books. That means slashing new loans, stop renewing existing loans, or even calling in loans. All three hit the small and medium businesses the hardest because regional banks are their lifelines. The mega banks generally do not bother with the little guy. After all, it's a lot easier to make a $1 billion loan to a Fortune 500 company or even to jet off to Mexico where American taxpayers will bail you out than it is to soak up that billion in thousands of family business loans. That low-level scout work, they leave to the regional banks, who are now failing. Kaplan actually came out and blamed the Fed, remember he's a former president so he can speak freely, for draining the regional banks to, his words, too big to fail banks. And he noted that further hikes, which the Fed is currently promising, will deepen the squeeze both on small banks and on these small businesses who need them to survive. Put it together and you've got banks desperately trying to shrink fast enough to outrun the Reaper, and they're using small business and households to do it. The big boys will get all the money they want. And so we are now at that dangerous quiet stage where the headlines are quiet, even as the trillion-dollar moves accelerate under the surface. Every day that passes, the regional banks are getting smaller, the small businesses are getting cut off, bankruptcy numbers are already telling us they're dropping out one by one, and when the crisis muscles its way back into the headlines, we can expect them to fall in droves. At which point, perhaps we get to that fourth stage of the crisis, when Wall Street bankers have to lay off the butler and figure out how the washing machine works. Is inflation all in your head? Or do we finally man up and blame the Google searches? Today, the Wall Street Journal covered an unintentionally hilarious paper by former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and former IMF economist Olivier Blanchard that tries to blame inflation on everything they can think of but the money printers. The journal notes correctly that Bernanke and Blanchard are among the, quote, world's most cited academic economists. In academia, most cited means most respected. So the hilarity says a lot about modern academic economics. On to the paper. From the journal's description and the paper's model, quote, inflation is a function of, among other things, the gap between the supply and demand for labor, the public's expectations of inflation, commodity prices, and supply chain disruptions derived from Google searches for shortage. In other words, they threw in the kitchen sink on that baby. Yes, even the Google searches, to desperately avoid telling the truth that money printing, including by the organizations that pay both their salaries, is what caused the inflation. By the way, not to get too far into the weeds, but that inflation expectations is a particularly cute statistics game they play to push money printing out of the equation. That one I will do a standalone video on, but suffice to say you can chase anything out of an equation that you want. As the saying goes, quote, torture the data long enough and it will tell you anything. Now, this is not just Bernanke and Blanchard covering, but this is par in monetary economics, the part of economics that deals with inflation. In the US, roughly 90% of monetary economists are literally paid by the Federal Reserve or its proxies, either directly in salary or in the form of academic grants that are a very polite way to say bribe. This means, to a first approximation, any academic economist is simping for the Fed, reciting the party line. I, for the record, have never been paid by a central bank. I would be both shocked and amused if they offered. So back to the paper. Their conclusion after 47 pages with appendix of suitably tortured statistics is that runaway inflation was a, quote, complicated phenomenon involving, quote, excess savings, reopening of economies, and strong aggregate demand with only a bit role for government, to which the solution, in the journal's phrasing, is, quote, the economy has to cool off, which means a weaker labor market. In other words, it's all very complicated, but Americans spent too much, they expected too much, and the solution is to crush them, crush millions of jobs and tens of thousands of businesses. So what would an economist who is not paid by the Fed and the IMF say? Simple. They printed an ungodly amount of money to bribe voters into lockdown, $6 trillion in 3 years, to the point nearly $1 in $3 still had fresh ink. Then, when all that money flooded into inflation, instead of cutting government spending, they decided to beat it out of the people, out of workers and small businesses. Now, at this point, we have a golden opportunity with the debt ceiling to correct that mistake so that, for once, they cut government spending down to size instead of cutting the people down to size. Of course, most likely, they will not take it. Thanks for listening. Follow to get next week's episode right in your inbox, and I hope to see you on Twitter and Substack.